I'm Lancer Blair, and this is Biblical Gardening, and we've already given the prayer, so I'm going to give you a little information about myself and my background really quickly, and then we'll get into the main topic here. I am the PK of a PK of a PK of a PK. Okay? So if people that don't understand that, my father was a preacher, my grandfather still is a preacher, my great-grandfather was a preacher, and there's some indications that my great-great-grandfather was a preacher, and you can't sling a cat around my family without hitting a deacon or a Sunday school teacher or an organist or something. And whenever my father was pulling us out of the faith and bringing us to the truth in scriptures, it caused a huge rift in the family. Extremely. So I got to a point where I was rebelling against the father a little bit, and I told him, I am not going to be a preacher, I'm not going to be a preacher, I'm not going to preach, and you can't make me. Has anybody ever been in that situation where like, oh my, what did I just say? So I'm not a preacher, but now I'm standing up in front of people teaching. Call it what you want to, yes. So I worked my way through college. I lived on the horse farm. I worked at the dairy farm. I got up in the mornings. I milked cows. I took care of fencing and hay, and I broke horses for the university. I lived there. I was a student worker. I'd worked two jobs, went to school full time. Then my dad got sick, went into the hospital, and he died while I was there, and I took care of my father while all that was going on. I flunked out of school, went back, flunked out again, took a semester off, went back, flunked out again, took a year off, went back and made 4.0. Well, as my father lay dying in the hospital there at the university, I swore by my heavenly father that I would finish college, because that was what my dad wanted all of his kids to do, was to go on to college. So I got that. I got it taken care of. Now this is how it can help me help other people. Okay. Out of sheer necessity, we had to garden at the house. We had 636 tomato plants, and we sold tomatoes at a roadside stand. I don't remember once being cheated by people. They would leave IOUs, and they'd come back several days later, and then they would pay us. So I have a little bit of experience in this, and I've got a little bit of book knowledge, so let's see if I can get this going on the road. All right. Who here likes tomatoes? Who here cannot stand the colored cardboard you get at the grocery store during the middle of winter? Okay. Well, I'm going to show you how to collect and save tomato seeds and keep them for yourself later on. So you can find a type of tomato you like. You can eat the best tasting tomato, save the seeds off that best tasting tomato, and replant it for the next season. So, okay, we will get into that in just a little bit. But I have heirloom seeds here to give away. There is a company called Baker Creek. They're here in Missouri. They are a Sabbath-keeping seed company. In fact, several of their employees are at a Sukkot several miles away. I talked to them, told them what I was going to do, and I asked them for a donation, and they sent $2,500 worth of seeds to be distributed. Now, these seeds are not your typical garden seeds. These are cold crops, most of them, predominantly cold crops. So you can go home right now and plant them. You don't have to wait till the spring. You can go home now and you can throw some heirloom lettuce out. You can throw some radishes out. I've got radishes up here. I've got deer tongue lettuce. I've got, well, basil will be for next spring. But I've got several different types of iceberg lettuce. I've got a few cabbages in there. I've got some bok choy. And I asked them for cold crops so that you could go home and do it right now. Okay. I've got several tomatoes that came out of my own garden at the house. And by the way, my tomatoes are still producing. They're still coming on. Is there a container in the back of the room that I could use? Maybe a bowl or something? Excuse me. Pardon me. What I'm going to do... That'll be fine. That'll be perfect.
don't you bring a 4-pound bag of tomatoes?
Do what?
Tell me if you bring a 4-pound bag of tomatoes.
You won't need a 4-pound bag of tomatoes. When you do this right, tomatoes will produce more than anything else you got. I put out like 10 different tomato plants, and I was just giving tomatoes away. What you want to do is find the tomato you want to keep. Okay? Normally it's something, do a taste testing party. You know, among your family. Bring all your tomatoes in, slice them up, you know, in the bowl, and say, which ones do you like the flavor of the best? Which ones do you want to see? Which ones suit your purpose? Whether you're canning, you're eating fresh, you're making salsa, you're making tomato sauce, you're making spaghetti sauce, you're already cooking it and you're putting it back. Find the ones that taste the best, are what you want, and then we're going to cut them. And what we're going to do is we're going to scrape the seeds out of them. See all that? All of you have cut a tomato before, I'm sure. You're going to scrape the seeds out of it. And each one of these seeds has a little bitty, kind of like jelly coating around it. Have you ever seen that? It's a little cushion. But what that jelly coating is, it is a growth inhibitor. It prevents that seed from germinating. So what you're going to do is you're going to put this out in a bowl, in a dish. It helps if it's a small container. And then you're going to fill it with water. And you're going to put water on that, and you're going to set it in a windowsill, and you're going to let it mold. You're going to let it mold. Let the bacteria in that mold dissolve that jelly coating, okay? And it usually takes about a week to do that. Set it up in the windowsill, just forget about it. And it's going to grow a nice, thick layer of gray, blue-green mold. Probably some little boys out there going, yeah! So, but that's what you want, okay? About a week later, you're going to take that and you're going to start rinsing it. You're going to pour some water in there and then pour it off. Pour some more water in there, pour it off, until you got just the seeds in there. And those seed coats will have disappeared. They will have been eaten away and they will have been dissolved. Now, here's the next step. Take those seeds, pack them dry, put them on maybe a paper towel or something like that, roll them up, put them in an airtight container, put them in someplace dark and dry, and they'll be ready to go for you next year. Okay? So now...
Okay, now will you recap all of that real quick?
Recap, okay.
Can you vacuum seal?
Yes, you can vacuum seal, but there's really no reason to, because they should last through the winter. Put them in a Ziploc baggie. You know, a Ziploc baggie, you can put them in the freezer, but make sure you've got insulation around them, like several layers of paper towels, something like that, so they don't get too cold and freeze them and kill them.
Dry paper towels, not wet.
Right, dry paper towels. Okay, so once you've got the seed coat off, I'm going to recap that. Once you have the seed coat off, you know, that's after the mold and everything has been on top. After the mold and everything has been on top, you take the water, you drain them back and forth, you got just the seeds. Okay? Blot them dry. Get them as dry as you can, just under normal circumstances. You don't have to dry them with a hair dryer. Set them out in the sun. Don't have to do that. Just blot them dry with a nice paper towel. Then take the paper, or take a dry paper towel, put them onto it, roll them up, and put them in a nice, dark, dry area, and preferably cool as well. The refrigerator works really good. You know, it's not going to get too cold to freeze and kill them, but it's going to get cold enough that they don't germinate, you know, accidentally. If you leave them in a basement, they might get damp, and it might warm up just a hair, you know, if they're not protected, and they might start sprouting on you. So you don't want to do that. And then next season, next spring, you can start these in little bitty containers on your windowsill before you plant them outside. Okay? Now, I've got books up here that can be passed around, and these are really good information books. They're not given away. These are my personal books. But you can get the names and the identification numbers off of them, and you can take a look at it. Those two books are for companion planting. You know, if you to get rid of pests naturally, and to put plants that naturally grow well together. You can put marigolds in with your tomatoes and things like that. Put garlic in with your roses. Okay? That one, I believe, is flowers with vegetables. Carrots love tomatoes. Okay. And that one over there is flowers. That one's vegetables and vegetables. That's flowers and vegetables. This one is an organic garden medicine book. Anybody that wants to save their own seeds, Okay? This is a really good book to get. This gentleman right here, he said he makes $250,000 a year on a quarter acre farm. But he probably lives close enough to a large city that he can take his produce and go directly into it, okay? If you want to know anything about soil, this is the book. The complete book of composting. This gentleman who wrote this has got all kinds of, you can take a look at that, all types of techniques, whether you want to do fast composting or slow composting. Okay? This is the all-natural insecticide, basically, and disease control. How do you get rid of them without killing yourself and killing the plants and killing everything around you? As a side note, who here knows a seven dust? Seven dust kills my honeybees. Seven dust will kill a honeybee just like that. And people use it all the time thinking it's one of the best insecticides out there that you can walk out in the garden and just, you know, wipe it off and eat it. Yeah, you can, but it just decimates the honeybee population. So, anybody want to take a look at this?
Now, do you have all these written down on a sheet?
No, I figured if you wanted to look at a book, you could grab the book, write the number down. This book is called High Yield Gardening. It's the old French method and how they supplied the entire population of Paris by packing in successful gardening. When one plant went out, another plant went in. When this one came out, another plant went in. And so they would take their gardening year-round with hot houses. And this is back, that technique was developed in the 1700s. So it can be very well done today. I'm sorry. This one has a little bit of everything, from bud grafting to strawberries to fruit trees to plants, anything you really want to know. This is very general knowledge, this book is, but it's very nice. Would you like to take a look at that, ma'am? Okay. Now, if you're planting and if you're just doing it for yourself, I prefer raised beds. Does everybody know what raised beds are? Okay. Loved it. However, there is a drawback to raised beds. Raised beds dry out a little bit faster than normal gardening in the ground. Let's put your sprinkler system on. But put a whole bunch of hay on top. But they both have their drawbacks. If you don't want the finances of a sprinkler system, you have to make your bed taller. You know, so there's more depth there, there's more soil there. If you put mulch on top of it, like the straw or whatever you use for mulch, that conserves the water, but then you also provide a hiding place for insects. Okay? My squash buds. Okay, let me read your... I knew I wanted a heckler in the audience. I just didn't know it was you. The squash bugs at my house, let me put it that way, just attacked my zucchini and my summer squash. They were decimating it. And then I took all the hay straw away from the bottom of my plants, and everything was better. I didn't need the mulch because my plants were big enough that they were shading the ground underneath it. But I was inadvertently providing a home to a pest that was decimating my crop. So, yes, ma'am.
Well, I found out that you have one nasturtium and one white radish around your hills of vining plants. It will keep away squash bugs, cucumber beetles, all of the varmints, those two things.
Okay, white radishes and nasturtiums. Okay, that's probably in the companion planting book. I planted marigolds all around my zucchini and my squash. Didn't do a thing. Just did not do a thing.
A lot of that stuff just doesn't work.
Right. Now, if you need to sell produce, if you need to make a little extra income and you're going to sell produce, I wouldn't recommend raised beds, really. I would put it in long rows. When we did the 636 tomato plants, our whole garden was just row after row after row. But they were still in a type of raised bed. They were in a raised mound. We didn't have walls on it, but I went through and I had a Troy built tiller, and I was sitting there going like, all the way through. And I'd take that dirt, And after I did a section, I'd pull this side up to the middle and pull that side up to the middle. And then we'd laid a string across the top and we flattened it. And our raised bed was about yay tall. And then when you took the dirt from the other side and put on top of that and this from that side, there was that much difference between where you were walking to where the plant was. And it made weeding so much easier. Just right here. Of course, I was a little shorter then, little kid. But that's how we did that. Okay, let's go to another subject. Soil.
How many pounds of tomatoes did you actually grow after the season was over?
I don't remember, but I do know that we had so many tomatoes left over, us kids went out in the garden and had a green tomato fight. So... However, if you have green tomatoes at the end of the season, wrap them up in newspaper, put them under your bed in a box, and whenever you want a ripe tomato, pull it out and put it in the windowsill, and it'll ripen up for you. Okay? You don't have to go into the grocery store to get a fresh tomato come December or whatever. And they'll last under the bed, wrapped in newspaper, will last several months. Okay? They will last several months.
But you got to check them often, or their smell will drive you out.
My grandfather did that too. We had an old box car, and he would put hay in there and then hand set potatoes. And we had potatoes back.
Your potatoes?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Eight potatoes, carrots, and your ribs.
Right. Now, your soil. You really need to augment your... Well, I don't know exactly where each and every garden here, obvious, is at, and I don't know the circumstances, but the more compost and the more organic matter you can have in your soil, I feel the better off you are. Except if you're going to raise blueberries. I bought a bunch of blueberries, and here I was making the soil really good, and I had compost in there, and I put worms in there, and it was just nice and dark and just rich, and I put them in there, and I killed my blueberries. My blueberries like acidic soil. There is a pH scale on your soils that go from 0 to 14, okay? And I probably had that soil at 7.5, okay? 7.5, or 6.5 to 7 is considered neutral. It's considered where most vegetables like it at, and I had it just a little bit basic, just a little bit above that. Killed them deader than a doornail. And I'm sitting there scratching my head, and I'm looking at it, and what am I doing wrong? It just didn't dawn on me. I should have known. I mean, I knew it, but it did not click. And they kept turning a little brown, a little red, or yellow around the edges. They were being poisoned, basically. Because of the basic in there was poisoning them. Just like you take another plant and put it in acidic soil, it'll kill it as well. The same thing killed my blueberries. So you need to find the type of soil that's good for the plants you want to grow. Most plants prefer a neutral soil to slightly acidic, 6.5 to 7. You can get a little above and a little below that and still do very well, but that is primary your target range. Yes, ma'am.
What do you put in your soil to make it acidic?
Sulfur.
You can do sulfur, okay? Right. You can put anything that is acidic in nature, oak leaves, pine needles, sulfur. There's a lot of minerals that have an acidic nature to them. Now, you have to be careful because you don't want to just drive the pH, just drop it just as quickly as can be. You've got to take it a little slowly and work with it a little bit. Like you're in the kitchen making a mixture. You're putting a recipe together.
Lots of peat moss for
blueberries. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, so the next time I do that, I'll do nothing but peat moss then.
So you can afford. They're growing just plain peat moss.
I know! He ought to be up here talking. you already did yours, right?
We're sharing information.
Absolutely, we're sharing information. So like I said, your soil is a living thing. If you think of it that way, you'll be better off. Your soil has got billions upon billions of bacteria per square inch. Okay? It is that bacteria that helps break down everything into the components that your plants can use. So you want the bacteria there. I have stopped worming my animals because the worming chemical comes through the feces and then kills all my worms in the ground. I've stopped doing that. I can't have that. The more worms you have in your garden, the better off your soil is going to be. So I start growing my worms. And then when I put a garden bed in, I sprinkle worms in the middle of it, and I've got red wigglers in my garden that they're only supposed to be yay big, but they're the size of my pinky and about that long. I mean, they're like red worms on, you know, acid. I don't know. Red wigglers on acid. So you need to take a look at your soil and how it's going to benefit you. And you want to preserve your soil. You don't want to kill it. Also, in between my garden beds, I grow grass. I don't have to keep a walkway that is barren. I keep a walkway that is grass. Grass conserves the moisture, increases aeration in the soil, reduces compaction, and it's natural. And it feels good on my feet if I want to walk around barefooted in the garden. And I take it and I mow it and I scrape the grass clippings up if I don't want to mulch them into the ground itself. And I use them as a mulch on my garden beds. And I pulled 3 weeds this year. It's just, I just have regular fescue grass.
Yeah. You don't want to use Bermuda grass.
Bermuda will become a weed.
And those ones that have the runners.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Okay, so what you're saying on these raised beds, then you plant grass out in between them?
Well, I didn't plant grass. The grass was already there. Here's how I built a raised bed. I knew this would come in handy. Basically, I went to my local feed store, and my feed store, on their pallets of feed that come in, I'll move this so everybody can see it. Maybe I'll just do it back here. My feed store has thick corrugated cardboard that their pallets have underneath the feed, and they give that away for free. So I grabbed the cardboard, and at my house, there's the ground right there. On the first raised bed, I went and took a digging fork, and I didn't dig it with a shovel. I put the prongs down in the ground, and I loosened it up. But I did not disturb the layers of the soil, because your soil, as you go further and further down, you have different types of bacteria, you have different types of bugs, you have different types of everything. It's like there's colonies, different colonies, and different layers of soil have different types of bacteria that live there. And when you flip-flop it by tilling, you destroy all the aeration, you destroy the roots, and you destroy bacteria. And you really don't want that. It's okay to do it once whenever you're breaking ground the first time, but if you do it a lot more than that, it's not going to benefit you in any way whatsoever. So I took my digging fork and I just aerated this a little bit, and then I laid cardboard down over the top of it. That cardboard is going to smother all that grass that was in there, okay? Plus, cardboard is a really good food for worms. It retains moisture, which is better for the worms. It provides an open space that the worms like to crawl on, and so it increases the worm activity. The more worm activity you got, the better your ground's going to be, because they leave the castings, which is a fancy word for worm poop, okay? So they leave all that right there, and they make this really, really good with all these aeration holes. Then I went, and I've got old lumber. It's 1x6s, 8 foot long, and I made my beds 8 foot long by 4 foot wide. Basically something I could sit on the edge and I could reach the middle of it. So I made my beds roughly 1 foot tall. Basically 1 foot tall right there. Okay? Then I went and I laid a layer of straw down right there. This is something else you don't necessarily have to do. It's just the way I did it right there. The straw increases the aeration. Okay? Because roots from plants have to have air in order to live. It's not just soil. They have to have air, they have to have water, and they have to have a combination of the two and a really good mixture to thrive. So then I went and put my manure down here. Then I put another layer of straw. Then I put another layer of manure. And that's how I made my first beds. And they do really, really well. But with all this straw in here, and as it's rotting down, it turns into the soil. With all that straw in there, it's really hard for them to stay wet. I can have 10 inches of rain overnight, and these beds will not be soaking wet. The water drains through them so fast that at times it is a problem. If it's a little bit dry outside, these beds will be very dry, and I'll have to go out there and water them.
Does any manure work, or you got something specific?
I have a free source. I have a stockyard in my hometown, and they've been scraping their manure for years and putting it on the back lot. Now, I don't know the source of the cattle that the manure came from, so there's probably some chemicals and insecticides and things like that that they put on there, but it's been sitting at their place for roughly 5 years. So 99.9% of it has leached out. And then what I do is I'll get a dump truck load of it, take it to my house, and set it there for another year. After it's come to my house, it'll set for a year off to the side, and it'll break down even further. Because once you move the dirt and move the manure, it gets air into the middle of it. The bacteria start thriving on the air again, and they break it down even further. So after it's broke down, so almost 6 years, then I put it into my garden, and it continues to break down a little bit, but it's primarily 95% of the way already broke down, but it's almost straight manure. I've got friends that use, they have sheep. She's got 60 head of Suffolk sheep. She's the third largest sheep producer in the state of Missouri. And that's what she uses on her garden. People use chicken manure, but chicken manure is really high in nitrogen. And you have to be very careful with high nitrogen source fertilizers because of the way it will burn the plants. So you have to do that. You have to take a look at the soil amendments you're putting in, and you have to take a look at what your soil needs. So find out what your soil needs. Usually beginners need to take a soil test, and you can send that off, and it'll come back, and it'll tell you what you have. And then you'll take a look at what you want, and then you can add it accordingly. Now, after you've gardened for a few years, then you can start getting, you know, you can tell by the way the plants act, generally what they need. You know, it's just like kids. One's gloomy or whatever, you're like, hey, come on, let's do this, come on, let's go. So after you've gardened for a while, then you'll find out, and you'll see little tricks, and you'll see everything popping up. Yes, ma'am.
I use those little pH testers at the farm store. Is that okay to use your soil?
Yes.
Okay.
It might not be as accurate, but it will give you a very good starting point, and it'll give you a rough guesstimate, and that's fine for just starting off and doing things.
Yeah.
But the more precise you want to be, you're probably going to have to go to, like an extension office or something like that, and they'll send the soil away. But I would say you're probably not more than, 0.2 off or anything like that. So you're very, very close. But if you want to be more precise, then you got to do more things. Yes, ma'am.
I use horse manure.
I
set out there for sooner.
Right.
So we got the free stuff. My husband had old rancher free
cedar posts.
Mm-hmm. You know, and so we made those into cedar posts. But my garden was struggling this year. I mean, I planted earth and April.
Mm-hmm.
And they're about this long now.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my radishes, they never did anything. They just ended up being very long. Collard greens did fantastic.
Eggplants
did good. Potatoes did good.
Right. There is one of the books out there. One of the books out there has got a list of amendments that you can put in the soil. And it tells you whether they're slow releasing, moderate releasing, or fast releasing, and what they have and what percentage-wise based off nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. And it's out there somewhere.
It's read.
Yes.
Get books and read, because if you think you can go out and plant a seed in your backyard and have something, you're going to be disappointed.
Actually, gardening is one of the most simplest things you can do, but then around you can turn around and make it into the most complicated thing you ever had. You can get by putting a seed in the garden, but if you want a good garden, read your butt off. You know, talk to farmers. Talk to the older generation. Okay? My grandparents had to go through the Great Depression, and my grandfather was telling me that they lived on the edge of a farm eating black-eyed peas all winter long. He couldn't stand them after them. He hated them. But that's what he had to do, and just think about it, we might have to do the same thing.
And bug the heck out of your county extension agent. He's a marvelous source of information, and just get to know him, and so forth.
So look, we've talked at soil. We talked a little bit about collecting seeds. There's no way I can go over everything in gardening. You can do individual greenhouses. You can use Ziploc bags as greenhouses in your kitchen. Okay, get your egg cartons, not the plastic kind, but the paper kind. Put a little soil in there. If you use If you use seedling starting mixture, there's not enough nutrients in it to support a plant. You have to get potting soil. If you start the seedlings in that seedling mixture, you're going to have to transplant them, okay? It's a finer mixture to start off with, but it will not carry you into a transplant mode. Do what?
Can you start off in the
potting soil? Yeah, you can start off in the potting soil, but some potting soils, you really have to check, they weigh their bags down with water. So all you're paying for is water. Okay? Have to look at it. And some of your potting soils are really big chunks. They got chunks of wood in there, chunks of, you know, clay. It's like, what were you thinking? So take a look at it. You can put little bitty containers in a Ziploc bag with dirt in them. Put your seeds in there, zip it up, put it in the windowsill, and you can use Ziploc baggies as a greenhouse. Yes, miss?
Do you have any idea how to kill grasshoppers?
Eat them.
They're great.
I normally don't have a problem with insects because I have chickens and I've got ducks around the house. Yes, sir. Yes, guineas kill grasshoppers as well. I guess what I'm going to do now is I'm going to turn it over to a question and answer type of thing, because I'd rather help you with something that you need help with than stand up and say anything about it. Yes, ma'am. What?
Do you add minerals to your soil?
I will add seaweed meal. Okay, I have a 50-pound bag of kelp meal that I got from my MFA services. Kelp meal. And I add that to my worm bin. I put that in my worm bin, and then whenever I put a garden bed in, I take a can full of worm dirt, which will have castings, it'll have baby worms, it'll have full adult worms, but it'll have that kelp meal in there. Plus, it's got all the kitchen refuse, all the kitchen scraps that have gone in there, and that's what I put in my garden bed. And I put like a small 1-pound coffee can to sprinkle it down the middle and then scatter it out. Yes, ma'am?
This will be going on my 6th year of gardening in one area.
Mm-hmm.
Should I not garden in that spot this year for the 7th year?
Exactly.
That area of rest?
The father knew what he was doing, okay? When he said the land is to remain fallow the 7th year, you're not to work it. It is a proven scientific fact. Now, they're just catching up to what the father said. If you will let the land lay fallow the 7th year, the land will actually rebuild the structure in the soil. The roots and everything that go there, they go back through it, they will set the structure back up, and it will improve the quality of your land. So you're improving the quality of your land, you're improving the produce that's going to come off of it the next year, and you're observing a commandment, which is the most important one of all. No, yes, sir.
Does that apply also to if you're running cattle on an area, or if you've got pasture?
Okay, pasture land in Scripture is different.
Okay.
From my understanding, in pasture land, you're not tearing up the soil, you're not ripping things out. You can, depending on what's your stocking rate?
About 2 per acre.
2 per acre. So you do intensive grazing, something like that?
It's pretty rotational.
Okay, rotational grazing. You can take a look at your stocking rate. Okay. Does anybody know what stocking rate is in here?
Yeah,
there's a few people right back over there. Okay. Stocking rate is gonna vary depending on where you're at in the country. I live here in Missouri, and stocking rate is how many cows can you have per acre, or how many acres per cow. So how heavy a concentration you're going to put on the pasture. But you're not ripping up the grass. You're not doing anything. From my understanding of Scripture, when it said let the land rest on the 7th year, it was dealing with the gardens and the wheat fields where everything was removed off. Those cows are still, they're putting the feces back on there, which is turning back into it. If you want to let it rest, I think that would be an excellent, excellent idea. I believe it would probably improve the quality of the pasture, you know, giving those grasses a chance to... The taller your grass is, the deeper your roots are generally going to be. Okay? There is a direct correlation between the two. When you overgraze and your grass is down to nubbins, when your cows are down there just picking on dirt, your roots are only going to be 2 to 3 inches deep. Okay? So the deeper your roots are, the better off your grasses are going to be. So I don't think that's part of the commandment, but I think it'd be an excellent idea to do. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, sir.
How do you look at rotation as to the 7th year rest? Rotating your crops and then letting one crop rest and go for the 7th year?
Well, there's two ways you can look at this. The Father said He would take care of you. Okay? You let the land rest on the seventh year, He'll take care of you. So either the Father's going to give you an overabundance of produce on the sixth year that will carry you through the seventh year, and you won't have to plant anything, or you can leave, you know, section of your garden fallow a year before, and it's on another seven-year section. However, that takes the emphasis off relying on the Father.
Right.
So I'm not here to look at spiritual things. I'm here to help people on a gardening aspect, and I wouldn't say that I'm qualified to delve into that subject on a spiritual level. Okay?
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Yes?
If you think of it, can you rephrase the question for taking
purposes? If I think of it.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Okay. What about, okay, let's say you grow wheat in a section or whatever. Wheat takes a lot out of the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And after 2 or 3 years, it kind of depletes. So there's a rotational. So, that's the way I was understanding that gentleman's question. Is between the 7 years, is, you know, 2 years of wheat, and then go with, like, back to peas or something like that. Is that would be better, would it not?
It would be better. However, you're still removing... Okay, the question was, if you grow wheat and you still have rotation of peas and things like that, which are a legume and which return nitrogen to the soil, do you still follow the seven-year...
Would it still follow the seven-year?
You still follow the seven-year, but would it be better? Is that what you're asking? Would it be better?
With the rotation.
Okay. Absolutely, it would be better. However, you're still removing the produce off that land as if it were a vegetable garden.
Right.
On the pasture situation, those cows, granted, they're eating the grass, but they're defecating right there, and they're returning the grass within a 24-hour period with enzymes and bacteria that promote a healthy soil. Okay. Also, with the cloven hood, they don't necessarily compact the soil because the soil can pop up in between it. So they're aerating, they're providing bacteria, they're providing a digested source of food for bacteria in the ground. So it's a cycle. They take a little bit out. So I think pasture is kind of set off to the side of that one. But your wheat fields, your barley fields, your corn fields, and corn is not a biblical grain. When you find corn in your Bible, that's a misprint. Corn is a Native American plant.
Amen.
That was brought up with the Incas from South America up here. Corn is strictly Native American, or North American, an American produce. So when it says corn in the Bible, just think grain, because that's probably what it was. I don't know for sure, but that's probably what it was.
My school is completely in nitrogen, so I have two plants for the winter.
Mm-hmm.
One and two for two peas. Do I need an inoculant to get this? I've read a little bit about inoculants.
Okay, so the question is, you're going to overwinter. Your soil is depleted with nitrogen, so you're thinking about overwintering with peas, and you wonder if I can.
Yeah.
Right, that's one step. And you wonder if you can inoculate if you need to. Okay, the question is, have you had peas there before?
No.
Okay, you've not had peas before. Typically, your peas and your legumes, they need some form of inoculation, okay? Whether you've had peas there in the past, that could have been your inoculation. But your bacteria, here's a little, we're going to stretch it out just a little bit. Legumes are a type of plant, they're a family of plants that have nodules on their roots. And what they do is they take atmospheric nitrogen, convert it into a form that plants can use, and they store it in the roots or the balls on the roots, okay? But plants can only use that nitrogen once the parent plant has died and the outer shell of that nodule has decayed. Then the plant releases the nitrogen out of the roots. However, that plant, let's say we take a pea plant. The pea that you put in the ground needs a certain bacteria that lives in the roots. It's not the plant itself, but it's a bacteria that lives in the plant that pulls the nitrogen down. So they actually find that bacteria in the soil and they'll gather it with their roots. The bacteria comes into the roots, develops a house basically in the root, and then starts pulling nitrogen in. If you don't have it in the soil to begin with, you're going to have to inoculate. You will find... Let's just say you had 10 pea plants and you didn't inoculate your soil, maybe one or two will really grow well. The rest will just be really stunted. If you inoculate, 9 or 10 will be nice big plants. But next year, you shouldn't have to inoculate because that bacteria will stay in the soil for several years. Okay.
My question was, how long do you grow the chickens?
Yeah.
For nitrogen, but I understand it's too hot. So, how much time would I need to
last
when I pull the chickens out of the garden spot until I can use that for the garden?
Okay, the question is the time lapse of overwintering chickens in the garden. You think the fertilizer is going to be too high in nitrogen? If you overwinter chickens in the garden, I've done that, and I didn't find it was too hot. Because it had time, it was in such small increments that when it was deposited, it had time to break down. So it was good soil amendments, it had nitrogen there, but it wasn't on such a level that it would burn and kill. So you could still overwinter your chickens in your garden.
Right up
until you get ready to plant. In fact, if you leave it on up until this day and then take them off, they'll be eating bugs and weed seeds and everything like that. Let me show you a diagram. There is an old popular mechanics book called Farm Manual, and what they did, they had two gardens, and each garden was side by side, and what they did is they put a chicken house there on the edge, and one year they'd run their chickens in here, and the next, and they'd have their garden in there. And they had two doors on this chicken house. And then the next year, they'd put the garden over here and run the chickens here. They would go back and forth. The chickens helped keep the bugs down, the weeds down, the weed seeds down. They'd go through and they'd scratch the soil, okay? And they'd provide fertilizer. So it greatly reduced your insects. It greatly reduced the amount of disease from overwintering plants, maybe in the foliage or something like that. It was really, really good. I have not gotten back to that, but I plan on it. I have not done that yet. Yes, ma'am.
So with that idea, then, when you're going to plant your garden, what would you do with the soil at that point from the chicken coop? Would you still do your cardboard and your straw?
What would I do to my soil after I had the chickens in there?
Chickens are there for a year, and now you're going to put your garden there. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do to that?
Well, okay, what am I going to do?
Not land or raised beds, I think
so. I'm going to do raised beds.
Well, but would you still do a layer on top of that?
No. What I would do probably, is I'd probably stir the soil up a little bit. Just mix it in just a little bit, but I wouldn't go any depth. You know, I might go an inch or two.
My question is that actually, from what I've seen personally, and to ask you as well, I know the scripture says you are to give of your first fruits of your garden. From what I've seen of our own personal garden, we put in 3 tomato plants this year. The one plant, first one that had any tomatoes on, we actually didn't give any first fruits of that. It's produced less than half of what our other 2 tomato plants did produce, but we gave a couple, 2-3 tomatoes to each of those plants. The first one was ripe. I know that, I guess my question is, also, in scripture, I think that it says you're supposed to let the first year fall. Is that
So your question is, how do first fruits apply to your gardening situation?
Correct.
Okay. Here's what I know. Anytime you give back to the Father, you're going to get blessed. Hands down. Anytime you do that, you're going to be blessed. I have an orchard at the house. I've got 50 trees. Okay? I've been taking the fruit off of those trees and either putting it back in the ground right there around, because it's still young. They're only 4 years old. I planted them 4 years ago. They were year-old trees when I planted. I should be getting fruit off them for myself next year, I believe. I might have to take a look at that scripture again. But this year, I considered it first fruits, and I took the fruit from those trees, and I gave it to somebody I knew that would understand what first fruits was. They understood it was a blessing. They understood the amount of labor and everything that went into it, and they knew the Father. Okay? And I'm a very blessed individual. Financially, maybe not so, but I'm a blessed individual. I just had a thought. Anybody here got limited space to garden? Okay. I saw in one of the books a very easy way to garden. They bought a bag of soil, okay? They plopped the bag of soil down. They put put the bag of soil down right there by the front steps. They cut a few holes in the plastic. They went and got a few plants. They put them right into the bag. They didn't dump it out on the ground. They didn't do anything else. Put them right in through the bag and then put some pretty mulch over the top of it, and they had their garden. So if you only have 2 foot by 2 foot, you can still have a garden. You can have pepper plants. You can have tomato plants. You can put your herbs around them. You can have basil. You can have sage. You can have oregano. You can have all this stuff in a 2 foot by 2 foot square. And that's basically called square foot gardening. And there's a book out there about that. Yes, ma'am.
You can also contain a garden.
Yes. You can contain a garden up on the porch.
And see different flies.
Yeah. In flower pots.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am. A worm bed.
Yeah.
Okay. My worm bed is an old freezer, an upright freezer. Do what?
I've got a bunch of bad stuff to use them.
Right. I took an old freezer. It's got a drain in it. Well, in hindsight, I should have put a few more drain holes in there. It's open to the outdoors, okay? I put several bags of peat moss. I laid the peat moss in there, and I wet it down. And I thoroughly wet it. And I brought it up, let the water sit there, and it soaked the water up. I put the garden hose in there, and I soaked it again. I soaked it until the water was draining out the end. I made sure everything was just as soaked as could be, let it drain off for about a day so it was very moist still, and then I went and took a bag of oatmeal. And I cooked oatmeal. Oatmeal, the guy I bought my worms from, he said, if you want your worms to be really, really good, feed them oatmeal. You cook it, it breaks it down, it's wet. See, worms don't eat the food itself. They eat the bacteria that grows on the food. As the bacteria breaks the food down, they eat the bacteria. Worms do not eat what you put in there. They eat what grows on it, the mold and everything like that. So I got some oatmeal, I cooked the oatmeal, I put it in there, and then I got my worms and put that in there. And they've basically, it was just peat moss that I used as a starter. And my worms are outside 24 hours a day. I don't bring them in. I started them in a thing in the house. That was a no-no. I'm not doing that again. They were crawling up out of there. You know, I had worms all over the basement. I'm picking them up. It was not fun. Yes, ma'am.
What percentage would you say is peat moss versus oatmeal?
99. Okay, what percentage on starting a worm bed is peat moss versus oatmeal? Peat moss is what I use as the basic for their soil. Okay, the oatmeal I put in there was only their food for a little bit. So I just cooked up about a pound of oatmeal and stuck it in there, and they started eating that. And then I started putting vegetable scraps, you know, potatoes and tomatoes and things like that. I've even put a little bit of meat in there, and they've handled it just fine. And because it's outside, I have not had any problems with odor of any kind. But when I've been around it, it smells really good. It smells nice and sweet. But because it is outside, I've had problems with it being too wet, and I've drowned my worms. I have drowned it, and I thought I killed them, so I wrote it off, didn't do anything about it. I come back, 2-3 months later, and I've got worms again. See, worm eggs can take being drowned. They can take being frozen. They can take the heat. They can take drought. The worm eggs themselves can take all that. You might kill off the worms, but then the eggs are there to hatch out the moment that the environment becomes favorable and suitable for them again. Yes, ma'am. No, my worms are okay. What do I do for shade for my worms? I don't do anything really, but they're out in the sun. See, worms will come up to the surface at night and then go down, because my worm bed is roughly 2 foot deep. So they'll go down during the day. I don't do anything for shade. Now, I do something for when it gets too dry. I'll go out there and take the garden hose and sprinkle them down and keep it moist. But I won't do anything for shade. It's sitting out in the sun. Absolutely. Now, if I wanted to, I could put a shade cloth over them, and it wouldn't affect them hardly at all. It probably would conserve the water if you were, you know, in more of a drier climate. We get roughly 75 inches of rain a year at my house. So
you gave it all this year. Except for the last 3 years that we got 100.
Yes, sir.
Earlier in the presentation,
you were talking about the squash, and you had put mulch around, and you felt like it increased the number of squash bugs you had. I come from a part of the country where my major problem is with squash vine borers. Okay. And what I have read about that is when the squash plants are just beginning to vine, then it's a good idea to put mulch around that, and oftentimes those eggs that are laid on the underneath side of the leaves will drop down, and they don't necessarily find their way back to the vine. They usually get in within the first foot or so of the vine where it comes out of the soil. Okay, that doesn't always work. And my fallback method when I end up with squash vine borers has been to inject BT into that. What do you think about that idea? Is that a good idea or not?
Bacillus, the bacteria that that's based off of, it's an all-natural occurring bacteria in the soil. However, it will affect, you know, beneficial grubs. It will affect beneficial insects. I don't use any insecticide in my garden. I don't use nothing. I go out there and I'm picking eggs. I'm picking squash bugs eggs off my plants. I would much rather spend a little bit of time picking the eggs off my plants than to kill beneficial insects that are out there. Because that BT, I know it's organic. I know it's recommended. If I was going to do something, I would probably use Dawn dishwashing liquid and water. And I'd probably spray things down.
This is something I'm injecting into the vine.
You're injecting into the vine. Okay, I can tell you honestly, I don't know about that. I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. Yes, ma'am.
What about using diatomaceous earth?
Diatomaceous earth is actually ground up seashells.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, it is an indiscriminate killer. It gets in the joints of bugs, okay, and what it does, it pierces them, and because they are fluid internally, they dry out. If you have a heavy infestation of something that the good bugs can't take care of, then I can see using something to help them along. But just realize that you will be killing ladybugs, you will be killing aphids, or you will be killing anything that's beneficial as well. So be very cautious about what you use. Yes, ma'am. Yes, you and I need to talk. After this, you and I need to talk.
But anyway, it seems to work. And then the other thing is I've got deer. I get deer from that. And, you know, try to put garlic oil and mix it with water and spray it around the edges. And it does keep out the deer.
I'll keep everything out.
I have dogs for that, so the deer aren't a problem around my house. Did you have was there somebody else?
Up in Wisconsin and Minnesota in that area, we have a big problem with Asian beetles.
Japanese beetles?
Yes.
Okay.
There's no ladybug. The ladybug doesn't bite. The ladybug doesn't sting.
Oh, the Asian ladybug. Okay. All right. Go ahead.
Yes, and those things, they'll bite me. And they're more of a pest, I guess. But I mean, I know it's really, they help with the aphids, but I mean, I hardly ever see aphids anymore. But the thing is that they didn't promote the growth of anybody. It's almost like they're killing out anybody before they ever doing anything else. Because we barely, I think I saw two ladybugs this whole year.
So your question is,
well, how do you get rid of them?
I don't know if you're going to be able to.
I don't.
Honestly, find out their natural predator. But if you bring in a predator, you'd have to bring in a predator of that and a predator of that and a predator of that. To me, I've got no problem with them because they're killing aphids. You're doing the same thing that our native ladybugs do. I think it's going to. At my home, we had a problem with Japanese beetles. Okay, they were all over the rose bushes, they were all over my fruit trees, but they've reached a peak and now they're declining because the native birds have realized that they can eat them. So they're only a problem for a while until the native species realize that they are a food source. So I think once the native species realize that those Asiatic ladybugs are a food source, then they will start declining as well and you'll see an increase in your native ladybugs. Okay.
One trick that we just do in the off with the Japanese tomatoes and the horned tomato worms, and what we do out in Arizona, I bought an old blender from a shop,
right,
flea market, and you put them in there with a little bit of water, and then blend the heck out of them, line them all up, and spray them right back on the rose bushes, and you won't have any problem at all.
Really?
Yeah, it's kind of yucky, but it works.
Right. What his statement was his solution for Japanese beetles and tomato hornworms was he took some, he collected them, put them in a blender, made a puree out of them, put them in a sprayer, and then sprayed them back on the plants, and he didn't have any problems with them. And I see you're sitting there going, no, no, no. What, you don't like your smoothies in the morning? Come on. Yes, sir.
I've heard that diatomaceous earth, I heard that product earlier. The cat's earthworms and soft body worms, have you heard that? As well as, like you make a mixture of garlic oil, cayenne pepper oil, and hawthorn oil, and you spray that, that'll pretty much eliminate any pests on your plants as well.
So, what's your question then exactly?
So, I guess my question is, have you heard that, and does that sound right to you as far as, and primarily with the diatomaceous earth?
I've heard that, but I don't know if I believe it 100%, because it's microscopic shards. It is itty bitty little spearheads. Okay, now maybe the earthworms are protected by the slime that's on them, and maybe it can't get into the body. I don't know, but I do know that it gets into the joints. On him, and you know, earthworms really don't have a whole lot of joints. So, you know, there's probably one thing of the fact, and good, but they will pierce the skin of the jointed insects. So on earthworms, I've been told it's good, but I don't know how far I'd take that. On the bugs, I do know that it kills them. Okay? Yes, sir.
I have a gardening question, but what would you recommend for moles and alarms?
A good dog. A good dog. My dog goes through and digs up the moles and she eats them. You know, that's what the Jack Russell Terriers were bred for. That's what all your Terriers were bred for. Yes, sir. Folks, please.
For 3 years, I had beautiful squash vines, blooms.
Mm-hmm.
But no fruit, no squash.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be a pollination problem or a soil problem?
It's more of a pollination problem. Your blooms, you're going to have more blooms on your plants when you have bone meal, which is potassium. No, phosphorus. Phosphorus in the soil, which is steamed bone meal, okay? Your nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. One is roots, one supplies primarily shoots, and the other one supplies primarily blooms. Your roots for like your potatoes are your potassium. Your nitrogen is for your green leafy matter, your shoots, and your phosphorus is for your blooms. So you had your phosphorus there, you had the blooms, but you probably didn't have something to go in there and pollinate. Okay? There is, I don't know if y'all know this or not, I'll get to you in just a second, sir, I see the hand, but there is a mass die-off of honeybees. Okay? I have honeybees, and I've lost a few hives, and they cannot pinpoint the exact problem at this time. Anytime they've seen a colony collapse, there is a mass, just a tangle of different things. They have viruses, they have pesticides, they have insecticides, they have all kinds of ailments on them, and they have never before, from my understanding, seen it on this scale. In history, they have had a few mass die-offs, you know, back in the 1800s, I was just told earlier this week, but nothing on this scale. So, promote your honeybees. If you have to, go out there and hand pollinate some things. It's going to take some time. Get you a small nuke. Learn how to keep bees. And not only will you, you know, have the pollination, honeybees are responsible for roughly 75% of all produce in this country. Okay? If we lose the honeybees, there's going to be mass starvation.
When you were building those raised beds,
yes, sir.
Are you basically a no-till gardener?
I have gone that direction because I understand. I'm getting to where I understand the complexity of the soil structure and how it benefits the plants that it's in. So I am going to no-till, and eventually my entire garden will be there. I still have a few rows of tomatoes that I put in, and I've got tomatoes on this end, tomatoes on that end, and pole beans in the middle, but it's just rows. But eventually I will have raised beds all over the place because it's for my personal garden. If I was going to produce something on an economic scale, I would have rows of things. I would have rows. Yes, sir.
Okay, when you're talking about the bees, I know I've heard the mites was a big thing there for a while, but the GMOs, I hear, are killing them more off than anything because of the all the garbage that's in them and what it'll do to us. But my question is, do you also see a problem? Because we used to have these neat spiders, they call them garden spiders, and they were great for the bugs and a lot of things. I don't see them anymore. I don't know if you've noticed that.
I had one in my garden this year. Normally we'd have two or three, but I had one. Does anybody know how they made GMOs? Genetically modified organisms. Okay. I went to the University of Missouri, Columbia. We had pigs that glowed in the dark there. You could walk into the dark room and the snouts and the hooves and the ears on these pigs would glow yellow. They took the gene from jellyfish and implanted it into the pigs so that they could have a marker gene to pull out for what they wanted to work with. Okay?
Oh, I kind of touched on the honeybee issue that with the die-off of the hives all across North America and even here down in South America too, we're going to have some unique challenges as we go into the future. Now, I'm from West Texas. We've had some unique challenges this year also.
Yeah.
Aside from all the fires, what I experienced was the UV radiation doubled over the summer. When I tried to harden my seedlings, I took them out on the back porch in the shade and left them out for 2 hours, and it killed all my plants. So I don't know if you've seen any of that stuff here, and I'm out in a place where a good year will give us 12 to 15 inches of rain every year.
Right.
Where we're at. Do you have a sense of things are changing? I accept it as part of the judgment the Father's bringing upon the nation, because we won't walk in His ways.
Absolutely.
So, do you have a sense about that coming, and do you have a sense about how should we be responding to that?
Okay, I can't preach about scriptural things, but I can tell you what I feel, okay? Does everybody understand that?
Yes.
Okay. My father told me a long time ago, he wrote his book for me. He wrote it for you. He wrote it for you. He had us in mind. He knew we were going to be here. He knew we were going to be facing this. He gave us the instructions before we got to it. Does that make anybody feel happy? As the rest of the world is running around with their head cut off, you know, like a chicken with its head cut off, they're running around, they're just crazy about things. I know that my father said if I turn to him and, you know, call upon the name of the Father, that I would be saved and I'm protected. I am his child and he loves me, okay? I don't get too worked up over it because I know what's going to happen. All hell's going to break loose. This world is going to be flipped upside down, topsy-turvy. There's going to be rioting. There's going to be starvation. There's going to be this, or at least I feel, okay? I feel this. But my father also gave me a brain that I can sit back and I can put my trust in him, and then he can say, okay, you might want to look at doing this. You might want to look at doing this. You need to look at this. You need to look at that. I can prepare, but I don't ever take my eyes off the Father. Okay? I can go to a doctor because the doctor can help me, but I don't ever replace the Father with the doctor. Okay? I feel that part of what we're seeing right now is nuclear fallout from the power plants from the tsunami in Japan. If you have seen, and I've been told, I haven't looked at this and I haven't verified it for myself, but I was told that the federal government has raised the acceptable levels of nuclear fallout that you could be exposed to. I was told that they have raised that several times over the last year since that tsunami crashed into it and the nuclear power plant and everything just went kaputty. So, yeah, they wouldn't have to put out warnings, is my understanding of it. Now, I could be wrong. You know, I'm not perfect by any means. But I think that's part of it. I also feel that we are entering... I believe that there's another planet in our solar system. Okay? There's ancient Phoenician texts that call it Nibiru. They call it the 10th planet. Has anybody ever read any books by Zachariah Sitchin? You know, called The Wars of God and Men and the 12th planet and all this stuff and the Nephilims and things like that. I do believe that when it comes through, it's going to alter our gravitational pull. It's going to cause mass... Right. It's going to cause weather patterns to go just crazy. Okay? And that's going to affect our food production. That's going to affect our lives. Absolutely. 100%. That's what it's going to do. Yeah, flip the poles. You can have pole switches. You can have, you know, your weather's going to change, things like that. But I don't get too worked up over it because I'm a child of the Almighty.
Yeah. I figured he'd give me a heads up so I should just get ready.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
I've seen in Walmart and stuff, kits where you can grow tomatoes in water.
Yes, it's called hydroponics.
Yes, and what do you think about that?
Well, how much water have you got? Is it worth growing that tomato plant in water, or is it worth drinking the water? Okay, if you live in a place like West Texas, how special is that water? Okay, you can grow your tomato in the ground and put a shade canopy over it and use less water. Hydroponics still works, but you're not. I don't think you're going to have the flavor because there's not the amount of... You're with hydroponics...
Maybe.
Do what, ma'am?
Or maybe the nutrition?
I don't think it's going to be as good as a soil-grown garden tomato. Okay? It's still going to give you a tomato, but it's going to be... I feel, okay, I've never tasted one, but I would suspect that it's going to be like a supermarket egg. It never tastes as good as the egg from the, you know, the farm chicken. The yolk's not as yellow. It's a little runny. It's not going to be as good. You got to look at it. Mass-produced eggs, the hens are given the bare essentials to produce an egg. They're not given a surplus of energy. They're not given a surplus of minerals. They're not given a surplus of fat and everything to be a just overabundant, healthy animal. They're given the bare minimum so they can make a profit off that. And I'm not saying that's bad, but that's not what I want. You know, I'd rather have my own flock of Dominickers at the house, you know, and go out and gather eggs. I know they've been eating bugs, they've been eating worms and everything like that. But that's what I'd rather have. So I'd rather have the soil-grown tomato versus the hydroponic tomato. Yes, sir. I personally don't think so. I think that had more to do with the harvesting. Because if you mix your oats and your wheat and your barley, they're all going to come harvested at different times. So what are you going to do when it's harvested? You'd have to walk out there and say, oh, I got to take that one, I got to take that one, I got to take that one. But that one's in the head, that one's a vive, you know, it's not ready yet. So what you're doing is you're complicating things.
The question
was, do I think seeds grown side by side was like the not to mix your fields of grain, right?
Well,
or maybe you can clarify that, please.
Yeah, the same section where it says, you know, don't create mules. It seemed like it was important to begin creating things that can't reproduce.
Okay.
I think it's a warning cycle. You mix the seed, you have it, you get reproduced, you get baby seeds.
That's not how you really get a hybrid. Okay, so the question is, don't mix your seeds, don't get hybrids, and that's what you're thinking the commandment is leading to, right? Okay. The actual commandment is, don't plant your crops in the same field, right?
It says, don't mix your seeds.
Don't mix your seeds.
It says, don't mix your fibers, don't mix your animals, and don't mix your seeds, all in one yard.
Okay. Well, when you mix your seeds and you spread them out and sow them, you're going to have all your different grass, your barley, your oats, your wheat, and everything come up all at once. And you can't harvest it. Okay, you cannot get the benefit out of that. That's what I would infer that that comes from. Hybrid plants are actually based off of heirlooms. Hybrid plants is where they've selected for this trait and this trait. Can I get a washcloth from the back so I can show something on the board up here? What they do is they select a family trait over here, and they select a family trait over here, and they bring the, you know, they work with two individual families or even three or four, and then they bring them together into two families, and they work with them just what they want, and they bring these together. And hybrids are generally, they will reproduce off seed most of the time, but they will not. Thank you. They will reproduce off seed, but they're not going to give you what you want. They're not going to be very... Hybrids are generally bred for disease resistance. They're bred to be able to ship a tomato from here while it's still green and get to the supermarket... maybe a little green, but they gassed it along the way. It was not developed in order, it was not bred to be ripened on the vine and to be hand-picked. It was designed and it was bred to be picked by machine. It was designed to stay green when it was picked. It was bred for transportation. It was bred for production. It wasn't bred for quality. Okay, those are what hybrids are. Now, you can still get a hybrid that will give you what you want, but when you take the seed from the hybrid, the seeds are not, or the genes from the genome and the codexes and all those are not lined up to produce something. Okay, it's called an F1 or a terminal cross is what it's called in animal genetics. You take a line that's good mothering ability, you take a line that's got good fathering ability, and you cross the two, and you come up with a superior animal, but it's only superior for that one generation. If you cross that again, because scientists or farmers or whatever have not spent the time and the effort to make that a line, so it would they haven't taken the time to stabilize the genes in it. Okay, you know what I mean? Stabilize the genes, pair them up to where you get the desired results every single time. You take seeds out of those, and what you're going to get is a menagerie. And you can look at unit squares, and you can tell what you're going to get. Let's say you have the gene for transportation ability. Okay, that's what they would select it for. Let's say it's a heterozygous gene, which means you have one dominant and one recessive gene. And you put that in there and you breed it to a plant exactly like that, a fourth of the time you're going to get somebody that's got nothing but dominant genes over here, which is going to give you a completely different trait. A fourth of the time you're going to have something that is completely recessive genes, and it's going to give you a completely different trait. And then half the time you're going to get that same gene as the parents, that's one dominant and one recessive, and that's going to give you what you want. But you won't know until the end of the season, and you spent all this time and energy into putting in the effort of growing these plants, and then you finally realize what you've got. You have to throw away half your crop after you've already harvested off of them. So that is the downfall of hybrids. But they're really good if that's what you're looking for and you're not looking at saving seeds. I would ask that, okay, these seeds are be given away, okay? These, if you want some seeds, take some seeds. I bought these seeds several years ago with my own tithe money, okay? Because I asked the father, I was like, Father, should I pay for somebody's electric bill? You know, they might need their electric bill paid. Should I take tithe and pay that? Or should I buy some seeds and feed people? And I didn't receive a negative answer of feeding people, so I bought some seeds. Well, right now they're at the end of their lifespan. So I need to get rid of these, and they need to be used. So please, feel free to take flowers, vegetables, herbs, whatever from here. That's that. I would ask if you take some out of here, please send Baker Creek a thank you letter. Okay, the people that donated this whole thing of seeds, they have pamphlets up here. They've got, if you're going to save seed off some of that, they have separation distances. Yes, ma'am. Okay, cold crops are meant to take a frost. There is the square foot gardening, and there's another book I read where a gentleman has taken his garden 11 months out of the year. Now, that's up in Maine. Wow. He lives in Maine, and he takes his garden 11 months out of the year. What he does is he uses a greenhouse, and he uses wind tunnels, and he uses row sheets, okay? But in the wintertime, he's getting broccoli and cauliflower and lettuce and Brussels sprouts and all these cold crops. And he puts them in soups and stews and things like that, and that's what he eats. But if he can take a garden 11 months out of the year, why can't I grow a garden 12 months out of the year here?
Yeah.
And why can't Texas or anybody south of here, you know, take it even, you know, 12 months out of the year with even less help?
We do that in Arizona.
Right. Didn't you have a question, ma'am?
I do. This, I can't think of his first name, but it's Baker, the American gardener.
Mm-hmm. Jerry Baker?
Jerry, thank you. We've been trying to figure the first thing out. What is your thought, theory, ideas on the different things that he uses?
Well,
since also on the tomatoes or spraying tobacco and whiskey and dishwashing soap.
Okay, well, what do I think about Jerry Baker and all of his little knick-knack traits that put things together? I honestly have not used a whole lot of them, but I don't see why they would not work. Okay?
Is it okay to spray on the plant?
Your beer? Yeah, you can put beer on. Dish soap. Dish soap, the main ingredient in dish soap is phosphorus. Okay? Have you ever wondered why all the lakes and everything have got a whole lot of algae bloom? It's because phosphorus cannot be removed on usual water treatment plants. Your normal water treatment plant cannot remove phosphorus from the water source. And when you have everybody using phosphorus in your dishwashing liquid, to your shampoos, to your laundry detergent, they cannot remove it out. So it goes into the lakes, it goes into the water source, and then all the algae grabs it and they bloom. Okay? So that's what dishwashing soap is. Dishwashing soap, the phosphorus in it is what causes it to be a good soap. I don't know of anything, and I've read his book several times. I've read all of them.
Yeah.
I think I've got all of them. Yeah, I've got several of them. I don't see anything wrong with what he's putting together. Now, I don't know how effective all of them are. I would say some of them are really effective and some of them aren't, but I don't know. Okay. They're... Yes, Matt. What is my favorite breed of chicken for eggs, for meat, and dual purpose? Okay, if you just want eggs, it also depends on what color you want. Do you like white eggs? Do you like brown eggs? Do you like pink eggs? Do you like purple eggs? Do you like blue eggs? Do you like green eggs? Okay? There is a breed of chicken called the Araucana.
Yeah.
Araucan. Okay? They're a pretty good egg layer. They're pretty good mamas. They lay colored eggs. And where I'm from, they call them the Easter egg chicken. And it makes me mad. And I'm like, nope. They're not. No, we will not have that around here. I tend to like the older breeds. I have Dominickers, but my strain of Dominicker isn't as broody as I would like it to be, so I need to find a more broody strain. I also like Golden Bufforpingtons. They're a very calm, very nice, very loving breed of chicken. They're basically a pet, yeah. Another good variety is your Rhode Island Reds. Your New Hampshire Reds are a good breed. You've got your Plymouth Rocks. There are a lot of good breeds out there. There's some heritage breeds that if you like growing something a little unusual and you like telling your neighbors about it, say, look what I got. You know, there's only 200 chickens of this in the United States. Cost me an arm and a leg to get these, but, you know, I like them. There's Spangled Sussex and all kinds of, you know, Silver-Laced Wyandottes and Golden-Laced Wyandottes and things like that. There's some really beautiful chickens out there. Just find what you like. And then you can start manipulating what you have to better suit your purpose on your farm. Okay? If you don't want them to range very far, then keep the eggs from the hens that stay very close around the barn. But if you want something that's going to range, you know, grab the hens that are out in the pastures that are away from the barn, put them in a cage, get the eggs off them, hatch them out, and you'll slowly develop what you want, but it will still be within that breed. Okay? Chickens are a wonderful, wonderful thing to have. I really like my chickens. I've got a 300 egg incubator that I typically hatch out babies. So, in fact, I got babies right now at the house. Was there another question? Yes, ma'am.
I want to know if you put bees and fall leaf spread over your garden.
No, ma'am. Nope. No, ma'am, I don't.
Is that a bad thing to do?
Well, What are your leaves? Where are they coming from? What plant are they coming from? You know, are they from an ornamental tree that has got, you know, fertilizer been added to it? Are they off oak trees at the house? How are they going to affect the soil? Are they going to decrease the acidity or increase the acidity? What are they going to do to it? So you need to know what you want before you apply something to the soil. Okay. Yes, sir.
I was going to say, I built earlier this year, Michael and Richard, a friend of ours sitting right here, a greenhouse. And hopefully they'll get up, maybe when they get older, at least try to do some stuff this into the winter. We're up in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
But a greenhouse can be made smaller. It can also be put alongside of the house and then adapt well to their particular home. But up against the windows, like right here,
mm-hmm.
and you can also gain passive solar heat from it. And you can even couple it up and have a couple of chickens inside the greenhouse during wintertime and have multiple uses. A greenhouse is very adaptable. It can be very affordable. And if a person didn't have a very large yard, but this is like a side yard, greenhouse might be a better alternative. And keep it protected from the environment.
Yeah, greenhouses are really good. I've got the glass to build mine at the house. I haven't done it yet. But another good alternative are cold frames. If you can't put up a huge greenhouse, you can get a window from a salvage yard and build a box to fit that window, put it out, face it south, and you can grow things in a 2-foot by 2-foot square garden during the winter months.